differentiate properly.
So, is Tony Blair right? My next guest is sceptical about the idea of Islamic radicalisation. He suggests the threat has been over-exaggerated. His name is Arun Kandani. Arun, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Richard.
Welcome. You were born and grew up in London. You moved to New York 4 years ago, where you now teach at New York University. Arun, and your book is entitled The Muslims Are Coming! Islamophobia, Extremism, and the Domestic War on Terror. Let's talk about what you heard there, first of all. What's your reaction to what you heard of Tony Blair there?
You know, Tony Blair, with him you have the kind of spectacle of a Labour Prime Minister who became a neoconservative, right? And like the neoconservatives here in the United States, he's basically supported every possible war in the Middle East, from Afghanistan, Iraq, Lebanon, Libya. He's been banging the drums for war with Iran. The only exceptions he makes are with Saudi Arabia, who we tend to support because they buy lots of our arms, despite being the most religiously reactionary regime in the region. He supports the Egyptian military. No kind of democratic values there. And he's responsible for the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people with the wars that he's launched. And so,
well, we have to be slightly careful with that, Arun.
That's
a complex picture, and there are many players, aren't there? And you can certainly argue he's one of them.
Well, even on the most conservative estimates, 650,000 people died in Iraq.
I know, but if Britain hadn't taken part in the war, it would have happened anyway, wouldn't it?
No, 650,000 people would not have.
America would have invaded anyway.
Well, it would have certainly been much harder for America to go to war without Tony Blair's support, and so he has to bear the responsibility for those hundreds of thousands of deaths. And, you know, how convenient with that hanging over him to then talk about this idea of Islamic ideology as the greatest threat to world security. Do we really need to make these points anymore? I think this must be obvious to everyone by now that when Blair talks about global security, he has absolutely no credibility.
I have read your book and... As I said at the beginning of the show, it's dense, and I don't necessarily mean that in a bad way. You're making an important argument, and a point, a complex argument, but are you saying that actually the greatest threat to security is the Western ideology about Islamic ideology? Does that make sense?
Well, the core argument is that we're in a kind of cycle of violence, right, where the British government, the US government, are kind of locked in this conflict with Al-Qaeda, right? And after 9/11, the British government, the American government themselves radicalized as much as anyone else and became more willing to use violence in a wider range of contexts. And so one of the things that's happened is that we've created a kind of ideology of the war on terror where we say the root cause of this threat that we face is to do with something that we're calling Islamist ideology, right? And what we do when we do that is we ignore our own role in the conflict, right? We just present ourselves as kind of being reactive to this genuine threat. But we are killing, far more people than Al-Qaeda ever kills in the name of this war on terror. Of course, we need to absolutely condemn anyone who takes the lives of civilians in terrorist attacks. But to do that without hypocrisy, we also need to condemn the violence of our own governments.
I have to say, I've never quite understood the maths. It just seems to me that if you explore the logic of the way that we have handled where we perceive threats to come from, then there seems at its core to be a belief that Western lives are worth more the Middle Eastern lives. Because if you are correct that even at conservative estimates 600,000 people died in Iraq, you wonder, and who knows how many people have died in Afghanistan, a war that was principally fought to prevent terrorist attacks in Britain and America. Well, even if one had succeeded, even if that logic makes sense, if we hadn't gone to war in Afghanistan, and because we hadn't gone to war there, there'd been an attack in the UK, it is extremely unlikely that the numbers of people killed would have been anywhere near the numbers of people that have been killed as a result of our war in Afghanistan or our war in Iraq. And so if you look at it in numbers terms, does it imply that we believe that our lives are worth more than Middle Eastern lives.
I mean, I think that's absolutely right. I think that, you know, in order to legitimize these wars, we've had to create the idea that Muslim lives are worth less than the lives of us in the West. You know, a whole set of Islamophobic ideas have kind of emerged to back that up. You know, the idea of the fanatic, the idea of, you know, Muslims as somehow needing to be brought into modernity through wars of aggression. So you know, and that's exactly what Blair's message is today. So I think you're right to see a kind of racism at the core of it. You know, and then apart from those kind of questions about foreign policy, it also legitimizes a whole set of policies domestically as well. So the kind of way in which we have introduced a kind of systematic surveillance of Muslim communities in Britain, the way we've introduced policies like we now have a policy where you can strip the citizenship of a British citizen, right? And this is something that's been used against a number of British Muslims, simply on the basis that we object to their ideology, right? So there's actually been a couple of people who have had their citizenship stripped while they've been out of the country on the say simply of the Home Secretary, and subsequently been killed in drone strikes, right, by the United States. So it provides a beautiful mechanism to avoid the headline that says British citizen killed by US drone strike. Yeah. We simply don't get that headline because we took away their citizenship a few months before they were killed.
Look, I'm uncomfortable with all of this stuff, and yet at the same time, I can also see why governments got to this point. And you're talking in your book as well about part of what the security apparatus do now is that they're essentially trying, like the Minority Report film, they're trying to predict who might become a terrorist. And when you start doing that, you do get into a pretty shady area. But there had to be a reaction to 9/11, and there had to be a reaction to the Madrid train bombing, and there had to be a reaction to 7/7. And I can see, I don't like it, but I can see why we got here. Can you? Do you understand how we got here?
I mean, I can see the kind of political process that led to these kinds of policies emerging, and that's what I write about in the book. You know, I think the of course there is a small number of people who have sought to carry out acts of violence against their fellow citizens.
There are, and the have been quite successful at rounding a few up, or at least we're led to understand that there have been very successful cases and prosecutions of homegrown terrorists.
Right.
And their successful arrest and prosecution will have come from intelligence, which will have been gathered in the ways that you describe and you aren't comfortable with.
No, that's not quite right. So,
okay.
So the point here is that, you know, of course we should be trying to gather intelligence on people who are actively involved in terrorist plots, right? But what's happened since 7/7 in particular is that we've widened our surveillance gathering to the whole Muslim population, and particularly people that we think have the wrong ideology. Right.
When you say the whole Muslim population, what do you mean? We're spying on every single Muslim in the UK.
But we've defined the entire Muslim community as suspect. So, for example, you look at something like the Preventing Violent Extremism program that Tony Blair introduced. It allocates funding for what is in part an intelligence gathering operation in proportion to the Muslim population in each local authority area, according to the 2001 census. So it's actually saying the more Muslims there are in a particular area, the more money we need to spend on intelligence gathering, right? So that kind of idea is taking the threat not to be, you know, a small number of people who are actively involved in plots, but a general problem with this community.
Okay. But right? Is there any correlation between the dawn raids that we hear of on terrorism suspects and areas with a higher Muslim population?
No, there's not.
Those dawn raids often take place in areas like Leicester and Birmingham, and they have higher Muslim populations than most of the cities.
right, if you want to look at the question of terrorism in Britain, firstly, it's as much about far-right extremism as extremism linked to Muslim communities. But there's a kind of deeper point here that I think is in a way, the crux of this. We have started to think of a common sense idea now. It's become common sense that some kind of extremist ideology is the root cause of terrorism. Okay, and so because it's hard to find the individuals who are involved in actively involved in terrorism itself, we've widened what we do to go after the extremist ideology instead. So we've started to kind of criminalize ideas rather than actions, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. And this is the problem. This is really the kind of fundamental error in how we go about counterterrorism. So what we're doing then is we're collecting all kinds of information about the religious opinions that people happen to have, what they say about foreign policy, and we assume that those are precursors to becoming involved in violence, when there's actually no evidence for that, right? When you actually try and see what these correlations are, those are very bad guides to whether someone's likely to be involved in terrorism.
We have seen examples of terrorists who attended speeches by hate preachers, for example, or read their speeches, or right, watched tapes of those speeches. Now, is that not a connection between the expressing of radical ideas and terrorism?
Well, it depends. To a certain extent, it depends on who you're talking about, which particular so-called hate preachers you're talking about. But you know, I think what we miss out when we overemphasize that is the fact that more often than not, what's been part of the story of how someone's ended up becoming a terrorist is simply watching the news about Iraq and you know, watching videos of violence in Iraq, right, which are not actually about some kind of religious hate preacher, but just simply facts about what's happening in the world. And unfortunately, that has been enough to push some people into the incorrect belief that it's okay to then kill your fellow citizens.
But there were, and I'm sure that's correct, that these wars have radicalised some people. I don't suppose anyone would dispute that. But there were examples of terrorist attacks from the likes of Al-Qaeda targeted against the West that predate the Iraq War, the Afghanistan War, and 9/11.
Well, not in Britain. Britain's, you know, if you look at the terrorism...
Well, there were attacks against America, weren't there? It was the USS Cole that was attacked.
Absolutely. But, I mean, you know, if you look at, if you look at Britain, the number of terrorist prosecutions more than double between 2003 and 2006, between 2006 and 2009, dropping down to the level they were at before 2003. Now, that kind of sudden upsurge in terrorist attacks from 2003 is not entirely due to the fact that at that point we side with America's war in Iraq, but that's a large part of it. And that is the piece that tends to get downplayed in the way we do counterterrorism and think about what an effective counterterrorism policy should be, because we don't really want to say that maybe we should change our foreign policy in order to reduce the problem of terrorism, to create political contexts around the world in which terrorism becomes less likely. We don't want to do that. So instead, we talk about radicalization as being driven by some kind of fanatical ideology, okay, right? And I think this
is... Is it not driven by... Is it not a connection?
Well, okay, so, you know, take, for example, Hamas, right, which is kind of normally seen as a, you know, group that's driven by some kind of fanatical hatred, and that's what causes it to get involved in terrorism. Well, Hamas uses a kind of religious ideology to legitimize its violence. That's certainly true. Mm. But it also uses a religious ideology to legitimize its ceasefires. So the decision to use violence in a particular context or not is not due to the religious ideology part of its thought process. What's actually driving it to use violence or not is its interpretation of it, of the particular political context it's in, Israel's military occupation of Palestine, etc. Right. So, in order to understand whether Hamas is likely to be violent or not in a particular context, you need to look at the political context, not so much the religious ideology.
But are there not young people who are vulnerable to, susceptible to, a little bit, of want of a better phrase, brainwashing? That actually, are there not people who've grown up within certain communities in certain parts of the world, and maybe even communities within Britain, who've been told that this is God's will, that unbelievers should be killed, that favours will be granted in heaven, etc., that it isn't an extreme version of Islam sometimes used to get people to commit acts of terror?
You know, I think no one has become a suicide bomber because they think they're going to, you know, run into a load of virgins in heaven.
I think when you really look at the stories of the kind of biographies of
people who've become involved in terrorism, particularly in Britain and the United States, actually, brainwashing isn't really a very good way of describing what's happened to them. Right? What's happened to them is that they have looked at the world, right, and they've seen a world in which all kinds of injustices are taking place, and they're emotionally disturbed by those injustices, right? In the same way that, you know, 100 years ago, anarchists became terrorists for more or less the same reason, right? And they see the huge death toll around the world in places like Afghanistan, Iraq, Somalia, Yemen, Pakistan, and they identify the British and American governments as being the main cause of that violence. And they say, well, this is a war situation, and therefore I want to join this war and prevent this violence on those countries. And I consider myself to be a combatant, and therefore, you know, I'm willing to use violence myself. And obviously that logic
knowledge that you can escape death and that there is an afterlife and that you'll be granted favours, that has to play a part in your willingness to put your own life at risk. For a lot of people, surely.
I don't know where you get that certainty from.
Reading and watching
documentaries. In other words, this is the kind of the story that we've been sold over the last 15 years by so-called terrorism experts who've kind of much preferred to talk about this kind of idea of religious fanaticism than looking at the actual political context that caused this kind of violence and looking at the actual biographies of the terrorists themselves and looking at what terrorists actually say about their motivation.
So are you saying that British and American governments are more responsible for Islamic terrorism than the people that carry out the terrorism?
No, of course not. What I'm saying is if we're going to kind of think about the moral principles here, right, of course the prime moral responsibility for killing your fellow citizens is with the murderer, right? But then if we're going to condemn that murderer without hypocrisy, we also need to condemn our own government's greater violence that causes more civilians to be killed in other parts of the world, right? That's just a basic principle of morality.
Okay. Thank you very much indeed. It is a terrific book, and we've barely scratched the surface. It is called The Muslims Are Coming! Islamophobia, Extremism, and the Domestic War on Terror. But just look up The Muslims Are Coming. And it is by Arun Kundunani. A couple of texts before we go. Please point out to your guests that 90% of casualties in Iraq were killed by fellow Muslims. Secularism is to blame, not Tony Blair. Sectarianism is to blame, says Jane Bristol. Would Lee Rigby be alive if it was not for Islamic ideology? 7/7 didn't happen. Lee Rigby, not brutally murdered by Muslims. Are we supposed to be blind and deaf? Dear Richard says, Jack Horton of Bristol, I find it mind-blowing that some British Muslims feel the right to blackmail this country because of our foreign policy. Radical Islam is the enemy within this country. If people want to love and contribute to our democracy, then all is good. If they want to try and dictate our dealings with the world, then they're not deserving of living in a democracy such as ours. And finally, hello, Richard, Fiona of Sherburn. At last, she says of Arun, at last, someone talking sense about the West's disastrous treatment of the Middle East over the past 60 years. Bravo. There you go. A range of opinion here on BBC Radio.